This is Golf Today. Damon Hack alongside Eamon Lynch, Golf Week Magazine. What a Sunday along the shores of Lake Manassas.
How about that wedge shot of Lily Avuz? It really, to me, called to mind 83 Ryder Cup Lanny Watkins, the clinching point for the United States team when Jack Nicklaus was the captain. He stuffed a wedge in there, probably just outside of where Lily Avuz put that. That was back at PGA National in the day. But, I mean, Stacey Lewis was under a tremendous amount of pressure heading into this Solheim Cup. She didn't want to be the first U.S. captain to go 0-2 as a captain. It was a tie last time, but it's tantamount to a loss since Europe kept the cup. But she was just forensic in her approach to this, and everyone who needed to deliver for Team USA delivered, not least Stacey Lewis.
And Lily Avuz said she felt a lot of pressure, wasn't playing that well. On Sunday, she hit the shot required down the stretch. How about those Sunday singles results as the U.S. defeats Europe 15.5-12.5 for the Americans' first Solheim Cup victory since 2017. It must have felt a lot longer than that. Four U.S. players went undefeated this week. Rose Zhang, Megan Kang, Lauren Coughlin, and Andrea Lee. This was the first time in Solheim Cup history that the first five singles matches were decided prior to the 16th hole. Let's hear from the captain, Stacey Lewis, and her players after the win.
From the moment this team was together, they were together. There was no, we needed a couple days or anything like that. You know, the vibe in the team room was amazing. The way they got along, the way they supported each other, our group of caddies were, I mean, off the charts, keeping the team room loose, making sure everybody had fun, and it showed. It showed in the golf that was played, and I'm just so proud of them. I'm proud that they get this moment, or they get to celebrate tonight and win this cup.
Lily, you earned the point to capture the victory for the U.S. team. How important was that for not only yourself, but the team?
Oh, it was so important. I felt like in the middle of the match, wheels were kind of falling off. 16, I hit it through the green into the bunker, and I knew I had to make up and down, and then somehow birdied 17 and was able to hit it really close on 18. I knew, I looked at the leaderboard, I saw that we had 14 points, and like Stacey said at the beginning of the week, half points matter, so I only had one goal, was to get it close and get that birdie.
Lexi, potentially that was your final moment with your teammates out there. What did it mean to just get a win in your potential final cup?
Yeah, it was very special. It meant the world to me just to be here and to be part of this team. These girls are incredible. Words can't really describe just the personalities on this team and the talent that each and every one of them has. Like they've all said, from the beginning of the week, there was just something about this team that was different. The atmosphere, the energy, from the team rooms to the bus rides to the first tee experience. There was nothing like it, and just how we all came together and had fun and played some amazing golf on top of it. It was just great to be part of it.
Nelly, I'm curious where this week ranks on the fun scale for you over the course of your career.
Can you hear me? Yeah. This is probably the most fun I've had on a golf course ever. Just the team environment, the caddies, everyone getting along, the fans, everyone was so incredible. We all vibed really well off of each other, and this is probably the most I've laughed and the most I've fist pumped ever on a golf course, and it was just an amazing week and a dream come true.
I may be missing something, but where are the big bottles of champagne?
We haven't even been back to the team room yet. I think there were a couple. I think they drank them already.
That was a little bit of a joke, but you look a little bit drained up there. You look very relieved.
I think as most of them.
Do you feel like a burden's been lifted and you can just exhale?
I feel that way. I don't know how the rest of them feel. How do you guys feel?
I got some choice words that I'm not going to say, but we feel good. We feel like $1 million because we got the cup.
I think they're hungry and ready to go.
Amen.
Do you feel like you celebrate in a more mature way than maybe the guys?
We just haven't gotten a chance to yet.
Bring the bottles out and we'll see.
Oh, don't worry. They got to the champagne. Here's the U.S. team popping bottles. They ran around and hugged. They sang Whitney Houston songs. They got the job done. There we go. Popping those bottles and drinking champagne out of the Solheim Cup. And, you know, President Obama was omnipresent at RTJ really all week. He plays a lot of his golf there, joined the Americans before the Cup, and then posted this on X afterwards. Congrats to our new Solheim Cup champions. Proud of this talented team for bringing the Cup back home. You know, Eamon, sometimes in sports you don't get that chance of redemption. This American squad, for a lot of them, they had to wait 1 year, kind of sit on and stew on that tie from Spain. And I think that you used the word perfectly, meticulous. That's who Stacey Lewis is. But she got to turn it around after 1 year. She said there was some tears, some heartbreak. The flight home was very long from Spain. They got the job done. She pushed all the right buttons and seemingly made all the right moves.
And how many Ryder Cup captains over the years wish their number one and number two had stepped up in the manner that Stacey Lewis, as number one and two, stepped up, particularly Nelly Korda? She seemed to embrace this in a manner that was just joyous all week long, even letting the 6-4 defeat in the singles on Sunday just kind of wash off her back. Nelly Korda had a great week. And how about that partnership with Corpuz as well? It's basically, you know, it's the torpedo between the two of them, and it just destroyed the European side every time they face him. And that is the kind of anchor you can build a team around going forward. And then players like Rose Zhang as well and Megan Kang, who seemed to be the emotional centre of that team. It was just the very idea of a unified effort that we've seen very little of on the men's side over the years. We saw it in full bloom this weekend.
Yeah, the Americans had a lot of different options. You know, who was the anchor? You know, they had different anchors. You know, Lauren Coughlin playing, you know, not too far from where she grew up. Rose Zhang, a perfect 4-0-0. Megan King, as you mentioned, kind of the fire starter, the emotional leader who was fun inside the ropes and then outside the ropes, you know, singing Whitney Houston songs at full throttle. And Nelly King, I think this type of environment really kind of brought out the kid in her, brought out her best. You know, I think when you're playing stroke play and as an individual, it's a lot of serious work. And this is serious, but it's also fun. There's a true sisterhood here. And Stacey Lewis talked about it. We were a team from beginning to end. They were unified.
Yeah, everything in the clubhouse and everything inside the ropes could not really have gone any better for the United States team. The same can't be said for what happened outside the ropes, particularly the logistical hurdles that existed for fans trying to get into the golf course on Friday morning. And, you know, it's a simple statement of fact that the LPGA Tour kind of runs on fumes when it comes to resources. Mm. It doesn't have the resources that most other organizations in golf does. But this wasn't a question of resource. This was a question of competence. Mm. And it left a very sour taste that the LPGA Tour was simply not up to it. Molly Marcoux-Simon came out and she owned it, but she came out a day later and owned it, which I thought was too late. And the compensation being offered to those fans just seemed
too little,
pointless. Well, you're offering them tickets to an event. They already had tickets and they couldn't get in. That's not a compensation. That's not a way to win over the fans. It all felt a little half-hearted in terms of the approach that needed to be taken. It was owned, but it was owned too late, and the compensation to fans was insufficient. So it was a bruising week for the LPGA Tour, a terrific week for Team USA.
We'll dig into that. Lots of storylines to unpack. Let's continue the conversation with the Golf Today Roundtable. Welcome in our colleagues, Karen Stupples, on the call last week at Robert Trent Jones Golf Club. Stubbs, it's great to see you. Let's start with the good. Stacey Lewis, she loves math. She loves data. How is she able to push all the right buttons this past week?
Well, I think she had some really good help with Justin Ray, sort of correlating all those numbers together just to make sure that she had all the facts and figures in her hands. All the players had said she would sit there poring over mountains of paperwork, trying to get everything figured out, how she was going to put her team together, who was going to play with who. Now, obviously, personalities do come into play, but a lot of what she chose to do was a facts and figures base. And you know what it's like when you're even talking about golf. If you can back up your reasoning with numbers, it kind of makes sense for everybody and makes the whole team able to buy into her choices and her decisions. And the fact that she was able to do it so well was quite remarkable. She was, I mean, let's face it, she was really close to getting it right in Spain as well with that tie. But everything really did come together for her perfectly this week. And I think that the team that she had put together was absolutely fabulous for this event. I think the older members of the team, your Nelly Kordas and your Lexi Thompsons of the world that didn't actually play college golf, really benefited from having players like Rose Zhang, Andrea Lee, Alison Corpus that did play college golf with a much more team environment. Sort of that added to the whole bonding and them being able to come together. And I really enjoyed watching it happen. And I mean, all power to them. And they thoroughly deserved it. Their golf was absolutely spectacular.
Karen, Angela Stanford said that Nelly kind of set the tone for the week for the team, right down to choosing the music on the bus and arranging a speaker that wasn't there so that they could all enjoy themselves going to and from. And she just said in the sound we heard that it was the most fun she's ever had on a golf course. Are you surprised by how Nelly has absolutely embraced that team environment?
It's a side of Nelly that we don't normally see. I mean, she's very buttoned up on the golf course as a world number one. She goes about her business in a cool, calm, collected, calm kind of way. But I think being around Megan Kan and the younger members of the team really kind of brought out this side of her that really made a difference. And she was able to show everybody and the rest of the team exactly who the real Nelly Korda is. And it's a fun side. And I'd really love to see this Nelly Korda come out on the golf course when she's playing stroke play events. And I think every single member of the LPGA board and backroom staff there and everybody who's a fan of LPGA Tour Golf would love to see this Nelly Korda every single week. And if we were to see it, I mean, watch out everybody else, because she's already got 6 wins this season. Imagine what she could do if this was the Nelly Korda that came out every week.
Of course, she was the absolute star power on that team. I suppose at the other end of the fame scene, you had Lauren Coghlan, who was making her debut in the Solheim Cup, goes undefeated. Can you remember a more impressive debut in the Solheim Cup than hers?
I could go with Leona Maguire, but in all fairness, this is a serious accomplishment for Lauren Coghlan. She came in with the hot hand, wins in Canada, wins in Scotland. She's in great form, really experienced caddy on the bag in Terry McNamara, caddy for Annika for so many years in so many of these matches. And I think that she really came up big when the team needed her. You think about the combining that she did in the four ball and foursomes. And then just magnificent play on Sunday to get back in that match when she was down. Just a phenomenal performance all round, and I think the whole world knows who Lauren Coghlan is now.
Well, you mentioned Leona Maguire. Speaking of Leona, she had gone 7-2-1 in the previous two Solheim Cups. Had been a rock for Team Europe. The captain for Europe, Suzanne Pedersen, decided not to play her for the entirety of Saturday. Let's listen to Suzanne Pedersen's reasoning on Saturday evening.
Considering Leona Maguire's success the last couple Solheim Cups, what went into the decision to sit her for both sessions today?
Yeah, I mean, nobody can take away Leona's record, the value that she carries into the European team, playing or not playing. Just her presence on our team is very valuable. When it ended up being where we kind of stood after yesterday, we kind of had to go by form. Unfortunately, up until now, Leona hasn't kind of been, I don't know, the rock that I kind of was hoping for.
So Suzanne mentioned form. How about this from Leona on Sunday? Form is temporary, class is permanent. That after Leona beat Ali Ewing in singles. Now, Karen, Leona had been an absolute star. Hadn't she earned the right from her previous play in the Solheim Cup to be out there on Saturday, even with the defeat on Friday?
Yes and no. Yes, in so many ways that she's a player that does tend to rise to the occasion. And I would say that it was a shame across the board to not see her have the opportunity to play more often. That being said, that every player knows when they show up to a Solheim Cup, every single move they make is being watched and noted in terms of how they play, how they hit the tee shots, how they hit their approach shots, what the course looks like setting up for them. And I think what Suzanne saw was a golf course that played quite long. Leona's not the longest of players in the world. And she wasn't making very many birdies. And I think that proved out when you watched her play in the afternoon on Friday. She only had 2 birdies. And that doesn't really stack up too well, and particularly if you're playing a long course and you have to try and figure out how to maximize your birdie potentials, because let's face it, the Americans were throwing birdies at them. Pars were not winning golf holes. So I can understand where Suzanne is coming from, but I would also have liked to have seen Leona given another opportunity to try and turn things around, to kind of make things happen. And of course, we saw that happen on Sunday. She went out and won her singles quite handily, made enough birdies to secure that. I think she had four or so birdies on Sunday. So she's more than capable of doing it. I think that she just didn't prove it early enough in the week for Suzanne to go out and do what she wanted her to do. And when it comes to Suzanne saying, oh, she wasn't the rock, I don't know if she wanted Leona to step up and be a leader and to kind of take ownership as part of that team. But that's really not Leona's style. She's pretty calm and quiet in most ways, very understated. So I don't think she was ever really going to see that. And I think the expectations were a little different from both sides of the equation.
Karen, another episode that got a lot of attention during the week was when the caddies for Megan Kang and Alison Lee ripped off their shirts after Alison had holed out from the fairway. And I guess they had a bet going on with each other. And one thing that kind of got lost in all of these theatrics that we're looking at here is that Madeline Sagstrom and the European team still had a shot to play from the fairway while these guys get up to these antics. Do caddies have any business whatsoever injecting themselves into the middle of a competitive match?
Oh, that's an interesting question.
I know Suzanne thought it made light of it. She thought it was just kind of funny, but no one asked Madeline Sagstrom if she thought it was funny.
No, and I'm sure that there's a little bit of it can create a little beefiness, you know, when it comes to that match, when you see the caddies do that, and there's a huge, massive celebration. And I think if I was a European player, Madeline Sagstrom, I'd want to say, right, that's it, I'm gonna stuff you now, you know, in so many ways. I like it. It would make me more determined. And so it can work in both ways. And honestly, that's an American team that's having a lot of fun, something that nobody really expected to see. And quite frankly, I need to wash my eyes out again, having to see their shirts off again. I think it plays to the spirit of the game, and exactly what Stacey Lewis said about the caddies and how an important part they played for the American team within that team room and the atmosphere that they created of fun. And for the Americans, it was great. For the Europeans, obviously, it would have made me far more determined.
Well, shirtless caddies, not the only controversy over the past. We get into planes, trains, automobiles, and buses after the break. We continue our Solheim Cup conversation with Karen Stupple. Stups, one of the big stories, of course, the long lines on Friday morning, fans waiting in the parking lot 2-3 hours just to get shuttled over to RTJ. It took the LPGA commissioner Malik Marcoux-Simon to react on Saturday. Here's what she had to say about what went wrong.
It's a complicated question, and again, we were writing spreadsheets and trying to figure it all out. We didn't have enough buses in the morning, clearly. We didn't have, when we started the day, the staggering was to have sort of 3-4 times more during the course of the day, but they were scheduled to start later, and then there was some delays. The exact numbers, I can't tell you at every hour what we had, but let's just suffice it to say there were not enough.
The damage has been done. How concerned are you about what this looks like around the world? You know, negative headlines all around the world when the women's game is desperate for positive exposure.
Yeah, listen, our goal of this week, as you guys know, we've been working really hard to bring in more fans to the sport, bring in more fans to the LPGA. We've worked very hard to do that and to market this event, which is a marquee event. So yeah, it was extremely disappointing that we had any fan that didn't have the perfect experience that we expect. So I think, again, once the fans got here, and they all did get here, or most of them got here, the experience was off the charts. The first tee at noon was hopping, and, you know, the players' energy was tremendous. I think the fans, when they got here, they had a great time. Yes, it was disappointing. We're not happy with what happened, and I don't think it's going to have long-term damages to us. We have to make sure our fans know how much we care about them and how much, you know, we whiffed.
Was that like the LPGA operations team? Who exactly is responsible for the planning issues?
Yeah, I don't want to get into exactly who's, you know, the details of the responsibility. At the end of the day, I'm the leader of the organization and I have to own it. We have a tournament team that runs all of this, but, you know, I'm sitting up here in front of you as the leader of the LPGA and I need to own that.
Karen, you, of course, were on the ground on Friday. How bad was it? How big was this story?
It was pretty huge. And I think that the biggest, you know, shock to me was when you turn on the TV and or, you know, for me, being there in person on that first day, was seeing the empty stands, which was something I had not expected to see at all. And my immediate thought was, what in the world has happened? I mean, this is the, you know, the first tee is this place to be on Friday morning. Everybody wants to be there. You want to hear the songs and the chants and the, you know, the fun and games between the two sets of fans. And to see the empty seats was quite the shock. But obviously, as the morning went on, word got out as to why things were happening the way they were, and then of course you're like, well, crikey, how could things have got this? How did this go out of hand? How did this happen? Because you know how many tickets have been sold, you know how many people are going to try and get there. I think what did come out of the whole week was the volunteers, and everybody is trying to get the same shuttles in, and they were prioritizing volunteers getting into the grounds as opposed to the spectators. And I think that was where the big issue came. There was no separation of the two. And I think as the week went on, that's how things improved. But it was very jarring to see the empty stands.
Karen, there's also the issue, I suppose, of red flags did exist here because there were similar logistical issues last year in Spain. And that's not an LPGA event there. The LET and IMG run it over there. But there were at least warning signs that there had been logistical issues just a year ago. And our colleague Beth Ann Nichols wrote a very strong column about questioning whether or not the LPGA Tour is ready for prime time. Do you agree with Beth Ann's sentiment that it's time for some really hard questions to be asked at LPGA Tour headquarters and how they can mishandle an event that was otherwise a terrific week for the LPGA Tour and women's golf?
Well, I think for the most part, the LPGA doesn't run those other massive events. You think of the R&A running the AIG Women's Open, you've got the PGA of America running the KPMG Women's PGA, you've got the USGA running the US Women's Open, all of which have quite a huge influx of fans and spectators, and they all know how to run big events. This is a big, huge, sharp learning curve for the LPGA Tour, and unfortunately, it's kind of hit them very fast with what happened this week. They will definitely grow and learn from this. I feel really bad for everybody that was waiting in those lines. I mean, that had to be dreadful. I mean, little young kids that were going for the first time, waiting, being disappointed they weren't going to be at the first tee. Those are pretty hard stories to hear. And you could hear Molly really being quite regretful about how things had happened and how that had been let down. For sure, they will learn and grow from this. I don't remember these incidences happening at Inverness a few years ago when the last time America hosted it. But then, of course, that was COVID. So there wasn't going to be so many people going and doing it. So this is the first really big test that the LPGA have had. And I want to say that it's very bad form that they didn't realize that this was going to be a thing. But I also know that they will learn and grow from it.
Before we let you go, Karen, we're unlikely to see either Stacey Lewis or Suzanne Pedersen in the captain's seat next time around. Who are your predictions for the captains on either side?
I think for the American side, I think Angela Stanford will be the next in line, closely followed by Morgan Pressel. I think those two have now a track record of being an assistant captain, and I think it's actually crucial to have been in that role so you understand all the working that goes on behind the scenes of how everything happens during the week, how you put your pairings together, the timing of things. As a player, you don't really see that. You're so focused on your game. So you can't just go from being a player to going into that leadership captaincy role. So I think it's going to be Angela Stanford and then closely followed by Morgan Pressel. And then from the European side, I think it's got to be Anna Norquist. Now, I know everybody's going to say, but what if she plays? I don't know. In 2 years' time, a lot can happen in 2 years. And I think Anna actually would quite relish the role of being a captain rather than having to put her game on the line and be a player. I think she would like that captaincy role. And I think there's a whole bunch of influx of new European talent that's going to be coming up, waiting to take those spots and those places. I mean, you want young, fresh legs on that golf course that if you have to rely on them going five matches, you can.
So much for the captains to juggle, from dealing with the media, of course, to putting the matchups together. Karen, great to see you last week at RTJ and great to spend time with you today. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's been fantastic. Loved every second of it, guys. Thank you.
All right, Stubbs. And speaking of the future, how about the future Solheim Cup venues 2026 goes to the Netherlands golf course that has hosted the Dutch Open a couple of times. And how about 2028, Valhalla, which of course hosted four major champs in the men's game, most recently the 2024 PGA Championship, won by one Xander Schauffele. Welcome back to Golf Today. What a career Marco Mira has put together. A 16-time winner on the PGA Tour, with five of those wins coming at the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am. His connection to the Monterey Peninsula soulful when a California State Am there back in 1979 as well.
So in 1998, at the age of 41, he won the Masters for his first ever career major. And who could ever forget that 20-footer he made, breaking right to left across the 18th green. That was his 15th attempt at the Masters, but forever banished that title of the best never to win a major.
And then he got greedy, Eamon. 3 months later, he won his second major of the year, the Open at Royal Birkdale, beating 54-hole leader Brian Watts at a playoff. And the win would prove to be O'Meara's last on the PGA Tour, but he showed he was truly a world player. Take a look at the bio. The World Golf Hall of Fame member. You see that Masters and Open. You see the 16 wins, three PGA Tour Champions wins as well. Won the U.S. Amateur in 1979 and inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame in 2015. And it is great to welcome in Marco Mira now ahead of his final start at this week's Pure Insurance Championship. I imagine this is a very difficult decision, Mark. Thanks for joining us. How did you know that this week was the time to say goodbye?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Damon and Eamon. You know, it's something I've been kind of planning over the last two or three years. Obviously, my career has slowed down. I think I played three events 2.5 years ago, seven events last year, and only five this year. And I'm 67, almost ready to turn 68 in January, and I just felt like enough's enough. And I've been so blessed to play an incredible game for such a long time and meet so many great people. And I couldn't have picked a better place than to wind it down at Pebble Beach, which is, obviously said, the Pure Insurance next week. We play with a junior from the first tee, and it'll be a great walk. It'll be a kind of a sad walk, but it's one that I've been planning on, and I'm happy to do it.
Will you miss it, Mark? Not just the camaraderie among the guys out there, but the competition, because it's been such an enormous part of your life for the last half century.
You know, I will a little bit, Eamon, but to be fair, you know, I don't work at it as hard. I don't practice as hard. I'm not as motivated. And I have a lot of other things in my life that I love to do, you know, whether it's fly fishing or snowmobiling, or I have a lot of hobbies. So I think I can change the path that I'm on. But I also want to reminisce the great moments and great times that I've had in this great game.
You know, Mark, I have a connection to the Van Nuys par 3. Your connection to Pebble Beach is pretty darn special. You weren't there with Douglas Grant and Jack Neville in 1919, but you were there in the 1970s. What do you remember about laying eyes on Pebble Beach for the first time?
Yeah, Damon, I think the first time I came up was in 78 playing the Cal State Amateur. And look, I was truly amazed. I'd watched it on TV. A lot of us that play the game, or not even as a professional, but wish that we'd had an opportunity to go play Pebble Beach. And when I remember driving in the 17-mile drive in 78, I was just amazed at the beauty. I mean, the place is incredible. Forget about the fact that it's one of the great golf courses in the world, but the whole Monterey Peninsula is just a magical place. And then to win the 79 California State Amateur, I look at the past champions that have won the California State Amateur at Pebble Beach. There's a lot of great names on that trophy. And so I think that helped propel and give me a little confidence into playing well later that year and winning the U.S. Amateur. And then thinking, hey, maybe I got a chance to play professional golf. Give it a go.
And give it a go you did, Mark. A lot of golf fans will remember your attachment to Pebble Beach over the years, the 16 tour wins, particularly the two majors in 1998. How would you like Marco Mira, the golfer, to be remembered by golf fans?
Well, I think I would hope that, you know, the respect that I've hopefully tried to put forward to my fellow competitors, to the fans, to the media, to the sponsors, you know, I think, Eamon, it's just important to realize that golf is about not just only this generation or the generation that came before me, but it's the generations that are coming into the future, that we got to make sure that we maintain this amazing game. And look, as a kid that started out playing golf at a late stage of my life at 12 and a half, 13, and now played professional golf around the world for 44 years, I just think that it's a responsibility that I had. And then hopefully for these young players, you know, if there's ever any kind of help or advice I can give them, I'd want them to feel free to reach out to me, because I just believe that we have the greatest game that you could possibly play in the world, and I just want to make sure that that continues going on to the future.
Mark, you're a mentor now, but for a long time you were a kid, 1990, before that year's AT&T. I believe you gifted your father with a spot next to you in the Pro-Am for 1990, which you won. What do you remember about that time and that relationship with your dad?
It was probably one of the highlights of my career. I know I've been blessed to have a few, but I would tell you, Damon, that that year, I played one other time with my father as my amateur partner in 86. And then after I won in 89, I invited my dad to come back in 90. We played all four rounds, as you can see. And I won the tournament playing right alongside my father. And I just don't know of any sporting event that you can do something like that. And on that 18th hole, you know, to stand there with my caddy and with my dad and give him a hug and a kiss. Yeah, I mean, it brings tears to my eyes right now. My dad and mom are passed on, but I owe everything to my parents. I am who I am because of my father and my mother, and that was one of the highlights of my life and of my career.
So many great memories you've built over the years in this game. Mark, I reached out to your longtime friend and swing guru, Bruce Davidson, and asked him, what's a Mark O'Meara story that people need to know? And he said, you got to ask Mark about the 1998 match play final with Tiger, when Tiger made you putt a little tiddler putt. What happened?
Yeah, Eamon, it was in 98. We went back across the pond to play in the Cisco World Match Play. And in the semifinals, I played 36-hole matches. I played Vijay Singh. I clipped him 11 and 10. And Tiger was playing Ian Woosnam, and it went extra holes, 37 holes, and Tiger won. And so the next day, of course, you know, these two guys, Tiger Woods, Mark O'Meara, are going to play in the finals. That night before the finals, he came over to the house. We had dinner, and he's like, oh, Mark, isn't this great? You and I, two buds going at it head-to-head. And I was thinking to myself, God, I hope he doesn't beat me worse than I just beat Vijay today. We got out there, and you know, of course, everybody wants to see Tiger Woods play golf. I get it. I'm a fan, too. And Tiger got out there, and next thing you know, he's like 5-under through 7 holes. He's got the fist pumping going. I'm like 5 down. Finally, I look over, and I say, hey. I said, look, there's a lot of people out here. They're out here to see a show. You got to slow down. He goes, well, play better. And I'm like, I'm trying to. And I got around to the 11th hole. I hadn't won a hole yet, and I hit a good tee shot. I hit it about 2.5 feet. He hit it on the back edge. He putted it down to about 3 feet. And as you can see, he made me putt this putt. I mean, I looked over to him before I was going to putt it, and I said, Tiger, I said, he's on the back of the green, and there's, you know, 7,000 people around the green. And I said, you're not going to make me putt this, are you? And he looked over at me, he goes, well, you haven't won a hole yet, have you? And I was like, oh, my God. And I made it. And then as I was walking off the green, I went right to him with a mean look on my face. And I told him, I said, let me tell you something. I can't use the words right now on national TV, but I said, if you ever make me putt a putt like that again, our friendship is over. Do you understand what I'm saying? And I just blew right by him. And, you know, as the story goes, I ended up winning a few holes, and we ended up going to the very 36th hole, final hole. I was one up, and I made about a 14-footer for birdie because he was going to two-putt, and I clipped Tiger Woods one up in the Cisco World Match Play in 98. So, yeah, that's some of the great memories that I had playing alongside my dear friend Tiger Woods.
There you go, Tiger. If you're at home watching, recovering from back surgery, karma came and got you there. Now, Mark, you were seen very much as Tiger's mentor in the very earliest days of his career, even before you won those two majors in 1998. As Tiger kind of grew into his own man and you started taking major titles that he wanted, did that relationship change over the years?
No, Damon, I think I've said this many times. I mean, Eamon, I'm sorry, excuse me. I've said this many times that, I don't know if I would have won those two majors at 41 years of age if he hadn't come into my life. So I just think that when you play with greatness and you're around people like Tiger Woods, I may not be able to hit a ball like Tiger or play like Tiger Woods, But when you're around somebody like that, it helps elevate your ability to play this great game. And certainly he did that to me. And I've enjoyed, you know, watching the success that he's had and what he's done and the way he's maybe made this game so, I mean, accessible to so many people. And people watch our game now because of Tiger Woods and drawn way more viewership. So I just think that our relationship just came together at the perfect time in my life, in a career that I was having a decent career, but it helped kind of kept me going a little bit, I believe.
One thing you and Tiger both have in common, besides green jackets and claret jugs, is a mean club twirl. I thought you had one of the best in the business, Mark. When did you first start club twirling, especially with the irons and sometimes even with the woods? Because I always thought it was very pretty to watch.
Well, you're nice to say that, Damon. I would tell you that all comes about because of Lanny Watkins. I mean, Lanny Watkins was probably the first ultimate club twirler that I ever played golf with. And I don't know, I just kind of developed it. And then, of course, we've watched Tiger do it, you know, whatever he gets those different shots. You know, he'll hold his finish and twirl that club. That's kind of a cool thing. I don't think I'm a very cool person, but that's kind of a cool thing.
Now, Mark, you mentioned earlier the idea of how you had sort of been mentored by previous generations. You're happy to mentor those coming after you. And this idea of leaving the game in better shape than you found it, that it's a trust passed from generation to generation. Do you feel as though that sentiment exists much in the game these days, or as much as it did in your era? Or are you happy with what you see in terms of the landscape of the PGA Tour now?
You know, I would hope so, Eamon. I would say maybe not quite as much because of social media and the amount of money everybody's playing for and this and that. I understand that has an impact. But what I would say is that the players of today's generation and hopefully the future generations, you know, they can't lose sight of the fact that if it's not for the fan and if it's not for the media and if it's not for the volunteers and everybody that it comes together in a pool to make our game what it is, I just don't think players, you know, should lose that. They have to maintain the focus that they have that responsibility to make sure that they keep this game at a high, elevated level.
Mark, you've been one of the great interviews in the game. I can't imagine what the emotion's going to be like at Pebble Beach for you as you say goodbye. Thanks for your time today, and thanks for all you've given to this great game.
Damon, Eamon, thank you for having me on. And, yes, I really appreciate it. It'll be a great walk next week at Pebble.
There he is, World Golf Hall of Fame member Mark O'Meara. As we go, I want to remind you folks, tune in to PGA Tour Champions Learning Center featuring Mark O'Meara tonight at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time on Golf Channel. Maybe he'll teach you how to club twirl. Just saying. One thing he did do, won that U.S. Amateur back in 1979, beat his good buddy John Cook. Mark O'Meara getting the job done.
The Abbott and Costello of Golf Channel are joining us here, Rex Hoggard and Ryan Lavner, our senior writers. Ryan, three of the U.S. President's Cup team also played the Pro Core Championship in Napa. Sahith Theegala played really well, top 10. Wyndham Clark, Max Homa missed the cut. Is there an issue or a fear on the U.S. side of a competitive sharpness issue as they head to Montreal next week, as most guys will not have played since the Tour Championship? Or is there something to be said for staying home rather than going out and playing poorly?
Yeah, I probably think that there is a fear among Jim Furyk and his assistant captains about just what sort of form the Americans are going to show up. And keep in mind, this is not the five-week break that the U.S. Ryder Cup team had in 2023 following the end of the Tour Championship and then the start of the Ryder Cup in Rome. This is just a three-week break, but in all due respect to Sahith Theegala, Wyndham Clark, and Max Homa, who teed it up in Napa, the success of this American team is going to hinge on the performance of Scottie Scheffler, Xander Schauffele, and Colin Morikawa, the three best Americans on that team. I do think sharpness is going to be an issue. I do think potentially you do have some concern about how much they have left in the tank after what was a very long and difficult season. But in particular, those three players are going to be so important to Jim Furyk's team. Just look at what happened with the Solheim Cup on that American team. Nelly Korda, Megan King, Rose Zhang, Lauren Colgan. Those are the best players in the American team. Those players showed up at RTJ, and that's the reason why the Americans won.
Rex, as we prepare to watch Jim Furyk and Mike Weir and dissect every move they make, every breath they take, is there something we can learn from having watched Stacey Lewis and Suzanne Pedersen in their captaincies in the Solheim Cup.
Labner and I talked about it this morning on the podcast. That was like a TED Talk, watching her captain that team. And to be fair, she has a really, really good team. I kind of equated it to Kirby Smart and the University of Georgia. You only have to be so good of a coach when you have that much talent on the field. But she checked off every box. It was really an amazing performance from a captain's point of view. I love the way she dug into the analytics. I love the work that she did with our former colleague Justin Ray about making sure that these were the right teams, these were the right tee times, these were the right players on this team. And the way she was able to get the players to also buy into this, it was an amazing experience. I think that's the biggest challenge for a modern captain. It's not only trying to get the right players into the mix, but getting them to believe that this is why it's important for you to maybe sit out this session. And she also made it fun. I covered the Olympics, and Nelly Korda stood out as the person everyone wanted to see play well, and you could almost feel the tension every time I interviewed her. It wasn't there during the Solheim Cup. You would think that would be the one event when the tension would be the worst, but she seemed to love every minute of it.
And Rex, just to piggyback off of that point, I mean, strokes gained metrics have been used in the PGA Tour since 2003, but it's a relatively new phenomenon for the LPGA. It's only been around since 2021, and I thought that Stacey Lewis sort of ushered in a new era for Team USA. The analytics factored into her captain's pick, certainly, and favoring players who were so strong with their mid-irons. You could see that with the pairings and the strategy, with the order they were setting them out in, putting so much pressure on the European side. And I think, to touch on one of the points that you mentioned there, interpersonally, it was so important explaining to players through data and analytics and other insights why they're making the decisions, why they're sitting out, why they're going four sessions and not necessarily five. That's so important to get players to buy in. And I think you saw that on the opposite end of the spectrum with the Europeans, in particular Leona Maguire, who sort of questioned why she played just once during the team session when she thought that she was playing quite well. I think if you are an American Solheim Cup fan, you have to feel really encouraged by the way that they brought in the data analytics team and what that could mean for the future of this team.
Rex, there was an incident during the Solheim Cup that was kind of passed off in a lighthearted manner by most folks when the caddies for Megan Kang and Alison Lee ripped off their shirts. Did caddies not learn from Joe LaCava at the Ryder Cup to keep their theatrics out of team events, that they have no business injecting themselves into it?
As a man of a certain age, first and foremost, I don't know why any man wants to take his shirt off in public, especially if there's going to be TV cameras around. So yes, I think there's something to be gleaned from that. I think this goes to the excitement that we were just talking about. I believe, if I understand this correctly, that there was actually a bet made on the tee box about if someone pulled out, the caddies had to take their shirts off. It makes it fun, but to your point, what happened in Rome, that got ugly. I don't think any of us want to see that, and certainly this was borderline to that. The fact that the Americans won, the fact that there was so much emotion probably mitigates this a little bit. But yeah, no one wants to see caddies taking their shirts off, Eamon.
And you know, Ryan, Rory McIlroy was involved with that little set two with Joe LaCava at the Ryder Cup. Speaking of Rory, I'm going to be honest. I got buddies who get physically ill when Rory loses close golf tournaments. How does he get out of this doldrum that he's in? Has this become a pattern? The nearly man, even he's referred to himself as a nearly man.
I'm not sure how your buddies are feeling after what happened over the final hour at Royal County Down. I'm not sure, Eamon and Damon, if there's any player who is in more of a need of like a 3 or 4 month reset than Rory McIlroy. You can talk about the technical issues, and I think there's clearly like a sloppiness or an untidiness to Rory McIlroy's game. Brandel's talked for months, if not years, about the top of the position of Rory's backswing position and why that leads to some stray iron shots. And, you know, that's really going to be the biggest difference that he needs to make up if he wants to stay sort of neck and neck with a Scottie Scheffler and a Xander Schauffele. But I think, you know, mentally, this is where the bigger reset needs to happen. He has been beaten down so many times, not just competitive wise, but also in terms of public perception with the whole PGA Tour Live battle, that he just needs a break. Like, I'd love to see him take 3 or 4 months to just reset, get away from it, rediscover his love for the game and competition. He's going to be 36 years old in May. I would love to see him maximize these next 2 or 3 years of his athletic prime. Of course, that's not what's going to happen to the end of 2024. He has 4 more tournament starts. He has the made-for-TV event in December. He has TGL launching in January. It's going to continue to be a very busy time, but I hope that he can take the time away that's necessary to get his game in order and also to get his head in order for a monster 2025.
Rex, Ryan mentioned Live, which concluded its individual season-long race in Chicago at the weekend. John Rahm won, and you know, the overhead drone shot of John Rahm playing his last hole, it seemed to be spectators numbering in the tens out there watching this. I'm sure John Rahm, with an $18 million check, considers his 2024 a success. Would you consider Rahm's 2024 to be a successful year?
I think it's mixed. This goes back to the idea that we were going to watch what he did this year in the major championships and to the Olympics to a lesser degree and sort of base everything that he did in those events on his decision to join LIV Golf. The narrative being that somehow joining LIV Golf was going to take away from his competitive edge, that somehow that wasn't going to prepare him for the majors. I think if you look at his results, specifically in the major championships this year, there is something to that argument. There was something about 54 holes and shorts and shotgun starts and loud music that didn't seem to put him in the right frame of mind. But the other half of it is, now that he's won the individual title, I think there is something to be said for he is still a really, really good golfer, and that he's still going to find a way to contend when he comes back to the major championships in the future. But yeah, something was clearly off in the majors this year that hadn't been before, and I think it's fair to look at how he gets there, how he plays his way into the majors on LIV Golf. Maybe that's not the best case scenario.
Ryan, time was John Rahm, in front of a lot of people, was one of the most electric players in the game. You think back to his first PGA Tour win at Torrey Pines, his U.S. Open at Torrey Pines, his win in the playoffs at the BMW, that great battle with Dustin Johnson. When he wins in what basically amounts to an echo chamber, how much of a loss is it? How much is that electricity lost in professional golf when not that many people even know what he just did?
No, I think this year, if nothing else, proved that this is not sustainable. It's two tours with, you know, respective stars, whether it's LIV Golf and John Rahm and Scottie Scheffler and the PGA Tour, they are better if they're working in concert. And I think this week in particular, you had the DP World Tour playing at Royal County Down, arguably the best golf course on the planet. And you have LIV Golf playing just outside Chicago, one of the biggest markets in a sports and golf mad city. Like, we need to figure this out. Whatever the future and the vision for what pro golf is going to be, it needs to involve the best players on the best courses in the biggest market. I think this week in particular underscored just the importance of that going forward.
Last quick question for you guys, and it doesn't even require a word answer. It's a number answer. 155 years ago today, young Tom Morris made what is recognized as the first hole-in-one in golf, the eighth hole at Prestwick in the Open Championship. How many do you have? I'll start with zero.
I have zero as well.
We've all got zero.
Wow, 4-0.
Embarrassing.
It's sad. Wow. Keep trying, though. I'm going to go hug a tree right after this.
Absolutely. We just had Marco Mira on. He's going to teach us how to club twirl. Maybe he'll teach us how to give a hole-in-one as well. Rex and Ryan, that was a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
All right, folks. He's a four-time winner on the PGA Tour. He's making his debut as one of Jim Furyk's assistant captains. He competed for the U.S. team in 2017 and 2022, both victories, owns a 2-2-3 career record. And Kiz joins us now from Aiken, South Carolina. Always fun spending time with you, Kiz. We're in preparation mode, I would imagine, for the President's Cup. How are the preparations going in your mind?
I think we're really dialed in. You know, I've never been on this side before, but I feel like we're super organized. The team's all understand and being communicated what we expect of them and who we think we're going to play with each other. And I really feel good about where we are a week out from getting into Montreal.
What do you see as your role and what you bring to the team room, Kevin, other than the threat of showing off your ripped pectoral muscles to people?
I've been going to the tanning bed all week to get ready for Max Homa. You know, I think Jim wants me to be there to kind of be a liaison between the players and him. He's not on the regular tour as much, and so he feels comfortable leaning on Sneds and I and Stewie Sink that's still playing out there a good bit. You know, I feel comfortable talking to all the guys and relaying how they really feel back to Jim. And then, you know, I'm there to provide a little fun and trash talk to the guys and help guys stay motivated.
Yeah, Kiz, I'm always fascinated by the line between this is a business trip and this is a buddy's trip. How do you strike that balance between, you know, making sure the guys are sharp and ready to go, but they're not too wound up, that they're not playing the type of golf that needs to be played to win?
Well, we want to build a team atmosphere, D. We want guys to feel like we're all one. We want to do things together. We want to eat dinner together. We want to, you know, train together. We want to practice together. We want to all be together as much as possible. That's the biggest highlight from my two Cup teams that I was a player is you finally get to be in a team atmosphere. So let's spend the whole time together. You really learn more about your fellow playing competitors that are now your teammates, and you get to know each other on a level you never knew was possible. So we want to build as much together time as possible, but obviously we want guys to be ready to play. So whatever it takes for them to feel ready to play, we're going to try to mend both those gaps. So we're going to have some practice rounds where we're playing together, some practice rounds where guys are doing things that they need to do to get ready, and I think we're going to have a good balance of that.
On the subject of being ready to play, Kevin, only three of the team played last weekend in Napa at the Pro Court Championship. Most won't have played since the end of the FedEx Cup playoffs. Any concern about competitive sharpness heading into the week?
It's a good question. You know, one of the biggest feedbacks from Rome from the guys was they didn't feel ready, especially for the alternate shot day. They felt really rusty. So Jim and I and the rest of the captains have a pretty good plan to add some competition early on in practice to try to get some competitive reps in front of other players, in front of, the caddies, in front of, you know, put them in situations that seem stressful so that they feel like they're in a competitive mode before we tee it up on Thursday. I think that'll be super helpful during practice.
The internationals, no doubt, will try to take out the world number one, Scottie Scheffler, as well as beat the United States. You've been around Tiger Woods. Now you've been around Scottie Scheffler. What impresses you the most about the world number one and how he goes about his business?
I just love the way he prepares. You know, he prepares the same way now that he's number one as he did 5 years ago, 4 years ago when he came on the scene. He's very humble about all his great accomplishments so far in his career. And I think it's just a testament to the type of person he is, the type of person his parents raised. He may not be the most vocal leader we've ever seen, but he kind of leads through actions. And then that's what we're hoping to see from him next week is showing guys that this is the way I prepare. This is the way that I've been so successful. And I hope they all follow suit.
And your two teams, Kevin, you made once as an automatic qualifier and once as a captain's pick. Did you feel any difference in the pressure between those 2 weeks? Did you feel as a captain's pick that you had to justify Davis Love's faith in you to any extent?
I did. I definitely think there's a situation there where when you're a pick, you want to shine more than feel like you're on the team, you know. And I actually spoke that to Max last week on the range. I said, look, man, the trying out's over. You're on the team. Let's prepare to go to play well in Montreal. And we're all there together. We're all there to help each other. And it doesn't matter if you were the first guy or the last guy. It doesn't matter. And we're all one now.
You sat out the first session in your debut back in 2017, I believe. What were the nerves like when you finally did get to the first tee?
I think Phil was my partner in alternate shot, and it was the hardest tee shot on the course, and I was looking around for some words of encouragement. He was in the stands with the presidents taking selfies, so there was a lot of nerves and emotions going around. I was waiting on him to tap me on the back, and he was nowhere to be seen. In fact, I remember I hit it, and I looked up, and it was going down the middle. I thought, thank God, and he came down the fairway, you know, chasing after me. He said, where'd you go, partner? I was like, you didn't even watch me hit? So, interesting times. The first tee is always, we had dinner last week in Napa, all the captains that were there, and we all told interesting first tee stories. So everyone's got an interesting shot. In fact, Sneds and Furyk played together an alternate shot a few years ago, and Sneds told him on the way to the first tee, there's no way I can hit this tee ball. You got to hit first. And Jim just stepped up there and hit the worst duck hook in the left trees and goes, see Sneds, I'm nervous too. Let's go.
Kids, you wear a lot of hats these days. Assistant captain, you can still play a little. I love having you around Tommy Roy's truck and doing the announcing thing. What's been the biggest surprise in doing some golf commentary and broadcasting, maybe that you didn't know going into that role?
The biggest takeaway I've taken is I always thought there were too many commercials when I watched TV, and I don't think there's enough now that I'm doing TV. I'm all for teen commercials. I love the little minute and a half breaks to catch a breather. You know, we went like 2.5 hours commercial free at the end of the tour championship. And I was thinking, my brain is fried. I can't come up with anything else to say. So I either got to get smarter or we got to add more commercials.
Buddy, you nailed it. TV's a lot harder than it looks when you're not on this side of the camera. Great spending time with you. I'll see you in Montreal. And best of luck, buddy.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Go USA.